Hey, Prime members, you can binge 8 new episodes of the Mr. Ballin podcast 1 month early and all episodes ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Today's podcast will feature two stories about people whose disappearances are still totally shrouded in mystery. The audio from both of these stories has been pulled from our main YouTube channel and has been remastered for today's episode. The links to the original YouTube videos are in the description. The first story you'll hear is called The Jameson Family, and it's about one of the most famous family disappearances of all time. Their truck was found tucked away in a forest. It contained their emaciated dog and $32,000 in cash, but what they discovered next was truly horrifying. And the second and final story you'll hear is called The Siberian Cabin, and it's about four friends who stay the night in a cabin deep in a Siberian forest, and everything's going great until they wake up, when they immediately realize something was wrong. But before we get into today's stories, if you're a fan of the strange, dark, and mysterious delivered in story format, then you've come to the right podcast because that's all we do, and we upload twice a week, once on Monday and once on Thursday. So if that's of interest to you, the next time the Amazon Music follow button gives you their phone to please capture a once-in-a-lifetime picture for them, say of course you'll do it, but when you take it, be sure to leave your finger right over the camera's lens. Okay, let's get into our first story called The Jameson Family.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
In 2009, the Jameson family, which was Bobby, who was 44, Sherilyn, who was 40, and their daughter, Madison, who was 6 years old, were living in Eufaula, Oklahoma on lakefront property. While they seemed to be living a simple and happy life, behind the scenes, their life was in turmoil. Bobby suffered from bad chronic back pain that he had as a result of a car accident that he was in 2003. Sherilyn was bipolar. She was medicated for it, but she didn't always take her meds, causing her to lash out at her family members, and it caused bouts of severe depression. Bobby and Sherilyn also believed that their house was haunted by three or four spirits who lived on their roof. Bobby was so convinced of this that he went to his pastor and asked where he could buy special bullets that he could shoot at these spirits. So for all of these reasons, the Jameson family was actually looking to leave their property in Eufaula and move somewhere else and hopefully start all over again, fresh, with a new shot at happiness. After the Jamesons would vanish, their family and friends would say, "We had no idea any of this was happening. We had no idea they were even considering a move." Now, this move they were considering was not a typical move. They were not looking to move into another house. They were looking to move onto a piece of property where they could place their storage container and live in the storage container until at some point they were going to build a house on a mountain and then move into the house. And they had actually already found a plot of land about 30 miles away from where they were currently living in a town called Red Oak. Now, the storage container itself that they planned on living in was actually sitting on their property in Eufaula. And it drew a lot of attention from the neighbors because Sherilyn would graffiti on it, "The neighbors have poisoned our cats. Witches don't like it when you kill their cats," because it turns out Sherilyn believed that she was a witch. So unsurprisingly, the neighbors avoided the Jameson family at all cost. Several weeks before the Jameson family went missing, they actually brought in a male boarder. So a guy that was going to live with them and help with manual labor in exchange for room and board. The boarder was a white supremacist that immediately took exception to Sherilyn, who was part Native American. And so anytime Bobby was out of the house, the white supremacist boarder would get into a fight with Sherilyn. And one day it came to a head and Sherilyn drew a gun on the boarder and said to leave the property or she was going to shoot him. The boarder refused to leave, and so Sherilyn began firing shots into the ground at his feet until he left. Now, once the Jameson family disappeared, this white supremacist boarder became one of the primary suspects. But when the FBI found him, he had a rock-solid alibi and was quickly crossed off the list of potential suspects. On October 8th, 2009, Bobby, Sherilyn, their daughter Madison, and their dog Maisie load up the truck and they start driving towards Red Oak. They were apparently going to go scout out this piece of property that they wanted to purchase to live on with the storage container. Now, according to family and friends, it was not uncommon for the Jamesons to vanish for several days at a time without telling anybody where they went. And it would turn out that they would go into the woods for these retreats where they would get away from technology in the city. And when they were gone for a few days and no one had heard from them, no one thought twice about it. On top of this, Bobby and Sherilyn had informed Madison's school that they'd be pulling her out of class because they were going to be moving. So when Madison didn't show up for school, the school did not raise any alarms because they assumed she'd been pulled out of school. On October 16th, 2009, 8 days after the Jamesons had left their house to go scout out this property in Red Oak, a couple of hunters in the Panola Mountains, which is near Red Oak, found the Jamesons' truck parked on the side of the road. Now, these hunters are in the middle of nowhere, which means the truck is in the middle of nowhere. And so as they're walking over to it, they're expecting to see the owner of the truck. But as they get over to the truck, there is no owner anywhere. They called out a couple times to see if they could get this person's attention or whoever it was that owned it, and no one came over to them. They look in the truck and they see there is this very sick-looking dog sitting on the back seat. It would turn out it was the Jamesons' dog. It was Maisie. Now, the windows were up and the truck was locked, so the hunters called the police. Police show up, they break a window, and they get Maisie out of the truck. They give her food and water, and she would end up making a full recovery. They look in the vehicle, and all of the Jamesons' personal effects are in there. Their phones, their wallets, their jackets, their clothes. Underneath the front seat was $32,000 of cash in a bank bag. Also, they found this weird letter written by Sherilyn to Bobby that was this 11-page hate letter that basically accused Bobby of being a hermit, which seems like a strange thing to ramble for 11 pages about, but either way. The police did an initial search of the area looking for the Jamison family, but they couldn't find them. And so the running theory was they must have pulled over and walked into the woods for some reason, got turned around, and they're just lost, and we need to go find them. The police were able to use the cell phones that had been left inside of the vehicle and were able to use their GPS locations and track where the phones had been before coming to rest inside of this vehicle. And they saw that the cell phones had actually gone up the trail a little ways. They had been up towards the top of the mountain for about 15 minutes before coming back down and then wound up in the truck where they were when they were found. So the police walk up the hill to where the GPS said they had been, and they find all these footprints that look to be Madison's because there's a child's footprint as well as probably Bobby's and Sherilyn's. But they're nowhere to be found, and there's no clue of where they went after being up there. When they started scanning through each of the cell phones to see if there was any information about where they might have gone, they found on Bobby's phone a picture of Madison that was taken up at that little location that the GPS took them. The picture of Madison has been hotly contested on the internet for a long time now. It's hard to tell in the image if Madison is happy or sad. It's also unclear based on her body language if her parents are taking the photo or if this was kind of staged by someone else. So between the GPS showing that they had been at the top of this mountain at one point, plus the picture of Madison confirming she had at least been up there, the police started this massive search with that section on the mountain where they had been standing as kind of the center point. And they searched all around the Panola Mountains. But after an extensive search of this new area, they didn't find anything. No new leads had come in, so ultimately the search was called off. 4 years later, in November of 2013, some hikers were in the Panola Mountains, about 5 kilometers, maybe a little bit less, from where the Jamesons truck was found. And they come across skeletal remains of 3 individuals. It looked like 2 adults and a child. They were laying face down side by side, and it was clear that they were not complete skeletons, but there was enough there to know for sure that these are people. As soon as the police were called, everybody assumed this has to be the Jameson family. It would actually take almost a year before they were able to confirm that, yes, those bones are in fact the Jameson family. While the Oklahoma medical examiner was not able to determine a cause of death because the remains were just partial, they didn't have enough to work with, they did see that there was a big hole in the back of Bobby's skull, and there was other holes in some of the other bones that many people assumed were from bullets, but it was never determined if that actually was what it was from. As soon as it came out that it was the Jameson family's remains, the first prominent theory was that this had to have been a murder-suicide, where Sherilyn, who was mad at Bobby, she wrote that hate-filled 11-page letter that was found in the car. You know, she's unstable from not taking her medication to combat her bipolar disorder. She seems like the person that would take her family out and then turn on herself. But all of her family said she would never harm her daughter. Maybe she would have harmed Bobby, but she never would have harmed her daughter. Also, why would you have brought your dog along and left your dog in the car and $32,000 of cash in the car? So that doesn't fit that scenario at all. The next theory was, well, maybe they just pulled over, walked into the woods for some reason, and then got lost and died of exposure. And that's still definitely a possible theory, except at the time they went missing, the temperatures were very mild. They were not dropping below freezing at night. It didn't rain very much, so it was kind of perfect conditions to be lost in the woods. It would have taken quite a while for them to die from exposure. And if you add in the fact that they were searching that area that they were found in pretty extensively within a few days of them going missing, if they had been lost and were only a few kilometers from the road, they would have been found in that search, but they weren't. The next theory that friends and family of the Jameson family predominantly believe is they were kidnapped. That maybe, you know, they were driving on that road and someone flagged them down, whether it was someone they knew or someone that did not seem threatening, that caused them to get out of their car and come over to them, leaving their car the way it was with all of their belongings inside and with their dog inside, shut the door, they're not threatened. They walk over to this person or this group, and then something happens where they are either against their will or they're complicit, and they walk into the woods never to go back to their truck, and then they ultimately pass away in the woods just a few kilometers away. However, none of those theories can account for the very bizarre video footage that they have of the Jameson family on the day they left their house to go check out the property in Red Oak. So on October 8th, 2009, the video shows Bobby and Sherilyn making multiple trips, about 20 or more, from their house to their truck, where they're loading gear into their truck. But they appear to be almost in a trance, which is what the sheriff said when he first saw the video. They're walking back and forth and they're carrying their stuff into the truck, but periodically they're making trips without carrying anything. They're just walking to the truck with nothing in hand, looking at the truck and then walking back to the house. And then they come back out and they have something in their hands, and then the next trip they have nothing. And periodically on their trek back and forth, they would just stop and just turn and look off into the distance, not interacting with each other. Bobby and Sherilyn haven't spoken to each other at all. They're just doing this weird trance-like commute back and forth between truck and house before ultimately they load up the truck and they do leave. A lot of people speculated that, well, it looks like Bobby and Sherilyn must have been using drugs. But when they first found the truck and they searched the Jamesons' truck and they searched the Jameson family house, there was no traces of drugs anywhere, and their family said there's no history of drug abuse. There was also a theory that perhaps the Jameson family got tied up in a cult, and that was why they were moving and they were going to live this minimalist lifestyle, and they had brought cash to, you know, give to this cult, but in fact they had actually been the target of the cult and that was what led to their demise. Or maybe they were complicit and they wanted to sacrifice themselves or something, but no one really knows.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The next and final story of today's episode is called The Siberian Cabin.
When most people picture Russia in their minds, they picture European Russia, which is literally the part of Russia on the western side that sits in Europe and is by far the most populated part of the country. But European Russia only accounts for 23% of the total territory that is Russia. The other 77% is to the east of European Russia. It starts at the Ural mountain range and it extends all the way over 5 million square miles to the Pacific Ocean. And this vast, mostly forested expanse, which is 50 times bigger than the entire United Kingdom, is called Siberia. And Siberia is absolutely brutal. In Siberia, it is almost always freezing cold. Literally. The average annual temperature across all of Siberia is 32.9 degrees Fahrenheit. So it is 0.9 degrees above freezing, on average, every single day. In addition to the extremely deadly weather that exists basically year-round in Siberia, Siberia is also home to a bunch of huge deadly animals, such as the brown bear, which is the same as the infamous grizzly bear in North America, the gray wolf, which by size alone makes virtually all other wolves look like little puppies. Gray wolves can grow to be nearly 200 pounds. And of course, there is the highly intelligent Siberian tiger, who is perhaps one of the only predators on Earth that is known to seek out and kill people for revenge. For example, in 1997, a hunter named Vladimir Markov was walking through a Siberian forest when he came face to face with one of these Siberian tigers, and he ended up shooting the tiger before fleeing, except the tiger didn't die. Instead, it got up and secretly followed Vladimir all the way back to his cabin, and then this tiger camped out outside of the cabin until Vladimir came out again, and the tiger pounced, killed him, and ate him. And so, unsurprisingly, Siberia has an absolutely minuscule population relative to its massive size. However, there are some adventurous people out there who are drawn to Siberia for the same reasons that most other people avoid it. These adventurous people see Siberia as one of the last truly wild places on our planet, and they want to experience it for themselves. And one of these highly adventurous people was a young man named Colin Madsen. Colin, who came from a very successful American family, was a big outdoors enthusiast who at some point in his youth began researching Siberia because he fell in love with its rugged natural beauty. He quickly began researching not only Siberia, but Siberian culture and Russian culture, and also at some point he became fluent in the Russian language. Then, in 2013, when Colin was 22 years old, he left his home in Missouri and moved to Siberia. He settled in one of Siberia's few population centers, a city called Irkutsk, which is located in the southeast of Siberia and right along the edge of Lake Baikal, which is the world's deepest freshwater lake. Colin's Siberia plan was twofold. He would go to school while he was there, and he would go out and explore. And at first, his plan went perfectly. He was accepted into Moscow State Linguistic University in Irkutsk, and very quickly, he made friends who were eager to accompany him on his adventures out into the Siberian wilderness. From his arrival in Siberia in 2013 to 2016, Colin did well in his studies, and he spent countless hours exploring the forests and mountainous areas all around Lake Baikal and right outside of Irkutsk. In fact, Colin became so familiar with this region that he began volunteering with a nonprofit in the area that went around marking new trails, which meant Colin was literally venturing into the wilds of Siberia and just marking the trail as he went. So when Colin's family heard about what happened to him in 2016, they could not believe it. In March of 2016, Colin and three of his good hiking friends, one was American and two were Russian, decided they wanted to go on a hike together. They settled on hiking to the summit of Love Peak, which was a mountain located a few hours away from Irkutsk in a small village called Arshan. This hike was nothing compared to the gnarly Siberian wilderness hikes all four of these guys had been on before. The trail that led up to Love Peak, it was fairly steep, but it was incredibly well marked, and all four of these guys had hiked it several times before. However, because Colin and his friends were so experienced at hiking in Siberia, they knew that even the easiest hikes needed to be respected, because Siberia was still Siberia. There were dangers that lurked everywhere. And so the men called ahead to the village of Arshan, and they rented one of these small rustic cabins that's in the village that sits right at the base of Love Peak, and it's kind of tucked away in this forest. And so this cabin would serve as their sort of base camp and would allow them to arrive in Arshan, get their gear together, and then when they were ready, they could begin this hike to the summit. And so a few days later, on March 27th, Colin and his three friends loaded up their car and they drove west to Arshan. And when they got there, they stopped at a local store and got some supplies and then made their way to their cabin. Their cabin was just a single room with a few beds inside of it. It was enough to protect them from the elements, but really nothing more. As for a toilet, the cabin didn't have one, but there was an outhouse outside that they could use. So after the friends moved into the cabin and claimed their beds and put their things down, they all sat down and began prepping their gear and eating some food and chatting. And then finally, at 2 a.m., they decided they needed to go to sleep because their plan was to get on the path up to Love Peak by 7 a.m., which meant they needed to get up at 5 a.m. to make their final preparations. So at 2 a.m., the lights in the cabin turned off and the friends all fell asleep. And then 3 hours later, at 5 a.m., when the lights came back on again, it was immediately clear something was wrong. Colin was not in his bed. His friends assumed, when they looked over at his bed and saw his personal belongings were all still there, that Colin must have gotten up and headed outside, maybe to use the outhouse or go for a quick walk, and they just hadn't heard him leaving. And so the three friends initially just kind of shrugged off Colin's absence and said, you know, he'll be back any minute, most likely. And if for some reason he's not back soon, he'll certainly be back by 7 a.m. because that was the agreed upon time they would leave for this hike. But as the minutes ticked closer and closer to 7 a.m. and Colin still had not shown up or tried to call them or do anything, the friends started to worry. It just didn't make any sense that Colin would just get up and leave without telling them where he was going. Finally, at 7 a.m., when Colin still had not shown up, and the friends' cursory search of the outside area near the cabin had yielded no results, they decided they had to tell someone. And so they wrote a note addressed to Colin, and they put it on the front of their cabin door. And this note basically just told Colin, you know, if you come back here and you see this note, know that we're looking for you, so stay put or tell someone you're here. And so after putting up this note, the friends left the cabin and they headed to the nearest police station where they reported Colin missing. The police would eventually launch this huge search in and around Arshan, both in the forested area right around the village and then also up into the mountains near Love Peak. But despite this huge effort, no one could find Colin, at least not at first. On Monday, April 4th, so 8 days into Colin's disappearance, a group of searchers were looking in the forest about 1 mile away from the cabin where Colin and his friends had been staying, and they look up ahead and they see there is this clearing and there's something in the middle of it. And so the searchers begin moving their way towards this clearing, ducking under branches and stepping over brush, and when they get close enough, they can see Colin is in the clearing, and Colin is deceased. He was laying flat on his back with his left arm extended out to the side and his right arm extended but closer to his body, and both of his hands were clenched in tight fists. And on his hands and his wrists were visible abrasions and cuts, which later would be determined to have most likely been caused from someone or something holding onto him, trying to restrain Colin. Colin also had visible abrasions and cuts on the front of his neck. Colin's clothing, which consisted of a long-sleeve thermal shirt, heavy pants, and hiking boots, were ripped and torn in several places. And interestingly, Colin was not wearing socks under his boots. Now, that seems inconsequential, but Colin had had surgery on both of his ankles and had scar tissue on his ankles that if he didn't have socks on, those scars would rub against the inside of his boot, and he said it was very painful. So he always wore socks. Also, Colin's body showed virtually no signs of decomposition, and all of his wounds and abrasions looked, quote, fresh, according to medical personnel. In short, Colin looked like he had recently been in some sort of physical altercation, and whoever or whatever he was grappling with had eventually overpowered him and killed him, although it was not clear how he actually died. Russian authorities were very quick to suspect Colin's three friends who had been with him, but they were brought into the station and they denied having anything to do with Colin's death, and they all passed their lie detector tests. After that, Russian authorities quickly closed this case by concluding that, well, if his friends didn't do it, then that means Colin must have been high on drugs or drinking alcohol or both, and he just wandered out of his cabin and he got lost in the woods and he died of hypothermia. He froze to death. The end. However, Colin's parents just could not accept that as being what happened to their son. There were a lot of reasons for skepticism, but the main one was that Colin was an absolute expert at navigating this particular region of Siberia. And so the idea that he would leave his cabin for a quick walk or something and get so completely lost that he would die 8 days later seemed way too far-fetched. And so Colin's parents hired a US-based private lab to do a review of Russia's autopsy of Colin to give their opinion if the autopsy was accurate or not. And this US-based lab pretty much immediately found that the Russian autopsy was not remotely accurate. Number one, Colin was not under the influence of alcohol or drugs. He was sober. Although technically he did have very small amounts of THC in his urine, THC is the chemical that is found in marijuana, but the amount was so little, it basically meant he had consumed the THC days before he went missing. And so he would not have been remotely affected by that small amount of THC in his system. Number two, the lab determined that Colin almost certainly did not die from hypothermia. Instead, all signs pointed to Colin dying from being suffocated, meaning he was murdered, someone crushed his airway, or in some way restricted him from breathing, and that's what killed him. And three, based on the lack of decomposition, the freshness of the injuries on Colin's body, and the lack of animal predation on his body when they found him, indicated that Colin did not just wander out of his cabin and immediately die somewhere in the forest. Instead, he was alive for most of the time people were looking for him, meaning when they found him, he likely had died within hours of being found. And so these findings by this US-based lab kind of create a general theory about what must have happened to Colin. After Colin left the cabin in the early morning hours of March 28th, maybe to go to the outhouse or to go for a quick walk, when he went outside, someone or something was nearby, and they either lured Colin to them, or they straight up ambushed Colin and took him away. Now, we have no idea what happened to Colin after he was abducted, but we can safely assume that after being abducted and taken somewhere, he was alive, and he stayed alive for several days until on the eighth day of his disappearance, Colin was killed, likely by his captor, either at the spot where he was found, or he was killed somewhere else, maybe in the forest, and then moved to the spot where he was found. Many people believe it was the Russian government who targeted Colin, they kidnapped him, and they killed him. And their botched investigation into his death was actually a calculated cover-up. Colin had participated in at least one peaceful environmentalist-led protest in Siberia, and after the protest, Colin apparently got a written warning by the Russian police not to attend another protest. But why would Colin, who was just one of many people involved in these protests, be singled out by the Russian government and killed for his participation? And why would the government elect to kill Colin when he was with three of his closest friends who would immediately notice his absence? It just doesn't add up. Today, Colin's parents are still trying to figure out what happened to their son, but unfortunately, their son's case is closed in Russia, and so no one on the Russian side is talking to the parents or giving them any new information. And so as a result, they and the rest of us are left to wonder who or what was lurking in the shadows when Colin stepped out of the cabin that morning. And then where did they take him and what did they do to him for nearly a week before they killed him deep inside of that Siberian forest?
Thank you for listening to the Mr. Ballin podcast. If you enjoyed today's stories and you're looking for more bone-chilling content, be sure to check out all of our studio's podcasts, Mr. Ballin's Medical Mysteries, Bedtime Stories, and Run Fool. Just search for Ballin Studios wherever you get your podcasts and you'll find them all. Also, there are hundreds more stories like the ones you heard today, but in video format on our YouTube channel, which is just called Mr. Ballin. So that's going to do it. I really appreciate your support. Until next time, see ya. Hey, Prime members, you can binge 8 new episodes of the Mr. Ballin podcast 1 month early and all episodes ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. And before you go, please tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Hey, listeners, it's me, Mr. Ballin. I appreciate you all being fans of The Strange, Dark, and Mysterious, but let's be honest, sometimes you need a bit of humor to go alongside true crime. That's where the Morbid Podcast comes in. It's a lighthearted nightmare over there. Hosted by Elena, an autopsy technician, and Ash, a hairstylist, at its core, Morbid is a true crime, creepy history, and all things spooky podcast. But when Ash and Elena get together and tell stories, they do so in a way that not only shows the depth and detail of their research, but each episode also includes a touch of humor, a dash of sarcasm, and is garnished with just a little bit of cursing. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Morbid early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.